Live from NPR News in New York, this is the Bryant Park Project with Allison Stewart and Luke Burbank.
Greetings, dear listeners. It's Thursday, June 28th, 2007. I'm Luke Burbank.
And I'm Allison Stewart.
Allison, have you seen that scene in Flashdance when...
Oh, what a feeling.
They dump the water over her when she's dancing. That was me trying to walk from the subway to my apartment last night. It was a biblical flood, and I brought my umbrella today. I'm very excited about
it. Well, you're learning. From Seattle, I think you'd always have an umbrella on you.
You'd be surprised.
Coming up on the show today, an iPhone preview. It's an iPod, it's a phone, it's a video device, it's a floor wax, it's a dessert topping, it's all the above. We'll get a review from a technology correspondent from USA Today.
Also, we're going to take a ride on an 80-year-old roller coaster with some actual 80-year-olds.
And Stryker McGuire, that's a real person. He's Newsweek's...
I've seen some of his film work.
He's Newsweek's London bureau chief. He's going to make us care about the change in power in the UK.
Before that, though, we've got some news to get to with our fill-in newsboy, Matt Martinez. Take it away, Matty.
Good morning. These are the latest headlines from NPR News. The Senate Judiciary Committee issued subpoenas yesterday for documents from the White House, Vice President Dick Cheney's office, and the Justice Department over the so-called secret wiretapping program. Here's Chairman of the Committee, Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy.
They did this under some kind of an internal legal justification. I want to know what that so-called legal justification was and who gave it, because obviously it was done at a time when they said they hadn't done such a thing.
More on this story from NPR's David Green coming up later in the broadcast. Meanwhile, the White House is claiming executive privilege over another set of subpoenas. These ones over documents about the decision to fire a number of federal prosecutors. The documents in question belong to former presidential counsel Harriet Myers and former political director Sarah Taylor. A car bombing at a crowded Baghdad bus stop killed at least 15 people in the southern city of Basra, leaving three British soldiers dead. Another 14 people were hurt in the rush hour blast in the Baia neighborhood of Iraq's capital. A total of 156 British service members have died in Iraq since the U.S.-led invasion in March 2003. Firefighters racing the weather for control of a turbulent wildfire near Lake Tahoe got a bit of a break today as the high winds forecast to arrive by early afternoon held off, giving crews time to shore up defenses. So far, the wildfire has consumed more than 3,000 acres. Containment is not expected before next week. The Supreme Court has blocked the execution of a Texas killer whose lawyers argue that he should not be put to death because he's mentally ill. Scott Louis Panetti shot his in-laws to death 15 years ago in front of his wife and young daughter. New British Prime Minister Gordon Brown named his cabinet today. It includes the country's first female Home Secretary and one of the youngest foreign secretaries ever, 41-year-old David Miliband. Brown also named outgoing PM Tony Blair as Middle East envoy. More on the new Gordon Brown government and how it could affect you later in the show. Tainted Chinese toothpaste has been more widely distributed than originally thought. Roughly 900,000 tubes of toothpaste containing a poison used in some antifreeze has turned up in U.S. hospitals, prisons, and juvenile detention centers. That's according to the Food and Drug Administration. The administration is urging consumers to discard all Chinese toothpaste. U.S. officials say there have been no reports of illnesses caused by the toothpaste. Fashion designer Liz Claiborne has died. She built a fashion empire by taking women out of uptight suits and designing a wide range of affordable, colorful separates. She was often called the working woman's best friend. She died of cancer on Tuesday. She was 78. And the NBA draft takes place tonight. The two top players, Ohio State's Greg Oden and Texas's Kevin Durant, are considered two of the best draft prospects in recent NBA history. But which one will be taken first by the Portland Trail Blazers and which will be taken second by the Seattle Supersonics remains unknown. Those are the latest headlines from NPR News. I'll be back for an update at the bottom of the hour.
You know, if Kevin Durant goes to my beloved Seattle Supersonics, he better be able to beat other NBA teams by himself. That's what it's going to take. Hey, thanks. NPR's Matt Martinez with the news of the day.
I want to follow up on something that Matt mentioned in the newscast. The White House is saying no go to all those subpoenas issued yesterday, the ones that hope to get more info about the government's warrantless wiretapping. It might have been wireless as well.
Yeah.
The White House this morning making this assertion, have you ever heard of executive privilege? We don't have to give the documents up. It was
Why does that not surprise me, by the way? Well, that was the least surprising thing to ever cross the wire.
They didn't actually say exactly that. The White House counsel, Fred Fielding, said, quote, "We had hoped this matter could conclude with your committee receiving information in lieu of having to invoke executive privilege. Instead, we are at this conclusion." That was the lawyerese of it all.
The upshot, right, is that the Senate Judiciary Committee really wants to know what exactly is going on with this program, and they feel like the White House is stonewalling.
That's the exact word that Patrick Leahy used. He called it a consistent pattern of evasion and misdirection. Them's fighting words all the way around. I'm curious, Luke, is this check or is this checkmate when it comes down to it all?
Yeah, if only we had something like a White House correspondent who could maybe tell us about that.
Someone like NPR's David Greene. David?
Hey, guys.
Hey, can you give us a little bit of background on this? Why did the committee seek out these subpoenas now, considering this wiretapping story is kind of old?
So you are going to make me talk about executive privilege and not the NBA draft.
That's going to be later, David, you and me on a private phone call.
We'll do it. I'm there. It's a date. Yeah, this executive privilege is something that President Bush has been throwing around for a long time. And he essentially says, look, if let's say, you know, if I were the president and you guys were giving me this advice behind closed doors, you're going to be a lot more honest if you know that that's never going to be made public. So that's the principle that the president says he's protecting. He hasn't used it all that often, and it's been a few years. But now in this battle with Congress, Democrats want to see documents. They want to bring some people in for testimony, including former White House counsel Harriet Myers and the former White House political director Sarah Taylor, and basically Fred Fielding, who's the president's counsel now, who also happens to be a lawyer from the Nixon White House, which is a coincidence that President Bush might not want, basically told Congress today, as you said, it's a no-go on the documents because we are protecting this principle, meaning if there are documents floating around the White House where people like Sarah Taylor and Harriet Myers were giving advice on which federal prosecutors needed to be fired, if that happened to be going on, then the White House is saying that's the sort of stuff that we don't need to hand over.
So what can Congress do at this point if he's crossed his arm and said, there you go, executive privilege, do something?
Well, we'll see. It's probably going to escalate, and the next question will be if Congress actually tries to get these former White House staffers in to testify, it's possible that the White House would claim executive privilege again on the testimony. But
can you just keep saying that over and over again if you're the president?
That word.
Legislatively,
it's
that's the equivalent of just
a sexy news term, isn't it? Executive privilege.
Just putting your fingers in your ear and singing the Star Spangled Banner. That's the executive version of that, right? They can just keep claiming
it. But it might come to court. That's exactly where this could be headed if they can't come to some sort of agreement. And Democrats don't like what the White House has offered so far. And the White House has said, look, we'll have these people come in and talk privately without a transcript. Not an offer that the Democrats want, so they want to subpoena these people, and we'll see where it goes. Could be in court, though.
All right, David Greene, NPR's White House correspondent. Thanks for helping us out, David.
No problem.
And now, Allison, as you may have heard, Jesus Christ is coming back on Friday night at 6 o'clock. Wait, no, that's Saturday. Actually, something more important is happening on Friday at 6 o'clock. The iPhone gets unveiled. And there are people who are sleeping in line outside of Apple stores in order to have the privilege of plopping down $500 on one of these bad boys. And I'll tell you, somebody who would be sleeping outside an Apple store if his wife Mindy would let him is my buddy Ben Steele from L.A. Ben is an advertising writer in Los Angeles, but that's just what he does, so he has money to blow on Apple-related products and services. Hi, Benjamin.
Hey there, Luke. How's it going?
Good. You are pretty much obsessed with this phone. I want you to rate your excitement about the iPhone on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being if your cover band, Settle Down, was playing a live concert at Wembley Stadium. Okay, that's a 10. And then 1 being when you realized how bad I am at guitar when I was playing with your cover band. Where is it on the spectrum?
Well, it's a 10, if only based on fear of playing in front of public, you know, a large group of people. It's definitely a 10. This thing is generating a lot of excitement in my household.
Have you just been kind of like, how long have you been monitoring this? Would you say it's been years or months?
Well, I think, you know, in some ways, in loose ways, for years, you know, ever since Apple formed a partnership with Singular, and they came out with that first rocker phone a few years ago. I think a lot of people who are interested in Apple were looking for something like this and kind of waiting for it. But in the last year, things just went crazy, and there started to be, you know, fan creation. created versions of what the iPhone might look like, and a ton of speculation leading up to January's Macworld, where the announcement finally happened.
And you weren't like breathlessly following all of these updates or reading them, were you? Because that would be kind of loser-ish.
Yeah, that would be incredibly embarrassing. But yes, I have been breathlessly following them.
How does your wife Mindy feel about this? I was actually surprised to hear there was a wife involved in your life after hearing the stories of your obsession with the iPhone.
No, it's more than a fair question. I would say that patient tolerance would be the way I would describe her feeling about all of my sort of tech obsessions. I think that I think she thinks this stuff is really cool, but I also think for every iPhone, she would point to a drawer full of things that have turned out to be much less cool, but have generated almost as much excitement. So
what is your plan for getting your hands on one, Ben?
Well, my plan is to not sleep outside. It's only based on shame. what I'm going to do is, the Apple stores seem to be the epicenter of excitement. It seems like that's where all the focus is. But there are a lot more AT&T stores out there than there are Apple stores. And I think what I'm going to do is start cruising around on the way into work tomorrow and at lunch and various times throughout the afternoon, kind of cruise around to AT&T stores around here, because I just don't think the discipline at the distribution chain of an AT&T store is quite the same as an Apple store. So I think we may be able to get our hands on one a little earlier there. So we'll see.
Well, Ben, we don't mean to make you jealous, but we have somebody in studio right now who's actually had their hands on an iPhone for a good deal of time. Ed Begg is a technology correspondent with USA Today. So, Ed, how long have you had the iPhone in your possession?
A little over 2 weeks now.
How are you feeling about it?
And you've actually got it sitting here in the studio.
I'm staring at it right
actually,
now.
It actually emits a glow, like, in Pulp Fiction, Marcella Wallace's
right.
Soul.
That's right. Never mind the hype. It does so much more. No. It's a very cool device, as I've talked about seemingly endlessly over the last few days. It's a very cool device. It's not perfect.
All right. Well,
and I'm not obsessed with it, but I am excited to have it and love the fact that I have it, because I've never been more popular in my life.
Can I just hold it for a minute?
How much is it going to? No. Yeah. Of course you can.
All right. I know you've been on a media tour. I've seen you on CBS. You're on Talk of the Nation. You're on our show. Okay. For people who, for some reason, don't really know much about this, although there's been so much media coverage, tell me three things this phone can do that my average phone can't do.
Well, your average phone cannot come close to displaying pictures, even if it does, like this one does. I mean, phones obviously show pictures. This one, pictures come alive. I mean, so that would be one thing. Your average phone, even if it's a music phone, does not have a real iPod in it. And this is Steve Jobs liked to say this is the best iPod that Apple's ever produced. I would have to agree with a couple of caveats, the main thing being storage, but it's a widescreen iPod, so you could watch a movie on it with the aspect ratio that the director had in mind. So that would be two. And then there's the internet. It looks like the real deal internet. I mean, it's a real browser. It's a beautiful browser. Now, there are some issues. You can't play all streaming video because it doesn't adhere to Adobe Flash and some other formats. The biggest bugaboo, of course, is the Edge network, which has been real spotty in my tests here in the New York area. So it's not perfect in terms of speed, but in terms of presentation, no other phone comes close.
And the fly in the ointment I've heard from a lot of people is the fact that it's hooked up with AT&T,
right,
that their service is inconsistent.
Yes. Very spotty in my tests, again. I haven't taken it all over the country.
Sure.
I would have loved as a consumer to have choice. Whether you're a fan of Verizon or Sprint or anybody else, it would be nice to have choice. Well, you're not going to have that choice with the iPhone, at least for some time.
And can I just, in the interest of my buddy out in L.A., Ben, who's just been looking at this longingly online, I mean, like, he'll be looking at it, and then his wife will come and he'll switch over to a naughty movie, so she thinks he's looking at that. Ben, you want to ask a question, since you're so obsessed with this phone?
Yeah, what's it like to have the power to cure cancer?
It's funny. It doesn't do cancer. It does do global warming. Probably contributes to global warming. I don't know. It is pretty, I know you guys have talked about the hype attached to this. I certainly can't think of any product that's had this amount of attention. I mean, yeah, there have been things like Xbox or PlayStation or, go back to the Mazda Miata, but it's just remarkable.
My one question would be, you know, the virtual keyboard seemed to get a lot of questions early on. It seems like the early reviews are good. What do you feel using that thing?
And explain what a virtual keyboard is to people who aren't quite getting that.
Okay. Basically, unlike probably every other cell phone on the planet, there is no physical keyboard or keypad for making calls, for, you know, banging out text messages, whatever you're going to do. Instead, on this very large and lovely screen, Apple will pop up a virtual keyboard. It's a multi-touch display, and you use your fingers to do whatever you have to do. And the keyboard or keypad only show up as you need them. So if you're making a phone call, you get a keypad. If you're, you know, want to enter a web address, you'll get a keyboard. And so you use your fingers, and it does take some getting used to. There's, you know, a learning curve, you know. I still haven't fully mastered it, although I'm getting good. The keyboard or the keypad does have some intelligence built into it. It's software, of course, and so it can predict what you're going to type and help you correct mistakes on the fly.
$500 is a lot of money.
Yes.
$600 is a lot of money.
Yes.
Are you getting enough for this money? Is there enough bang and gee whiz in that for this money?
You know, I've been asked that a lot, and I'll answer it two ways. Yes, it's an expensive device for sure. You know, version 1.0 of a lot of products typically is, especially when it's, you know, gotten this much attention. If you want to impress your friends and neighbors and, you know, yeah, it's worth it. It measures up to the hype to a point. If you want the perfect device, no. Wait for version 2, version 3. And my guess is, you know, even if they may drop the price, because that's the way of the world in electronics, may take them a while. Or they'll leave the price where it is, but they'll, you know, pile on a bunch of features. So magic question, how much is it worth to you to impress your friends and neighbors and be the hip one on the block because you got one?
Apparently it's worth a lot to Ben, right, Ben?
Yeah.
$600 sounds about right.
All right. Ed Begg from USA Today. Thank you so much for sharing all your information and bringing that fancy thing in here.
Sure thing.
And thanks, Benji. Talk to you real soon.
My pleasure. Take care, guys.
All right. We're going to have lots more coming up, including a trip to Coney Island with some 80-year-olds on an 80-year-old coaster. That's coming up next on the Bryant Park Project. This is the Bryant Park Project. I'm Luke Burbank.
And I'm Allison Stewart.
I wish everyone, friend or foe, well. And that is that, the end.
So he says, Tony Blair, that's the end, saying goodbye to the House of Parliament yesterday, shortly after he gave the Queen his resignation. I'll stop with the accent. She appointed Gordon Brown the new Prime Minister. Before your eyes glaze over, everybody, stick with us, because we are going to introduce you to someone who might make you care about the change in power in Britain, coming up in a few minutes.
First, though, the part of this show that makes Allison's teeth grind.
I sure sound like tooth grinding.
I've definitely matured and grown a lot from this experience.
Yeah, that would be Paris the heiress, fresh out of jail. She was on Larry King Live last night, and she was dropping some serious knowledge.
What's your favorite Bible passage?
I don't have a favorite.
You read it every day?
In jail, I read a lot.
Gonna go to Mass?
Yes.
Only Larry King could possibly be more vapid than Paris Hilton when they're doing an interview. That was just kind of amazing to watch. Although you were not as amazed as I was, Allison. You would be fine with us never mentioning Paris Hilton.
Yes, as we've been discussing, I fought hard. I made my case to not have Paris Hilton be part of our Virgin Voyage as part of the Bryant Park Project, a show.
Why, can I ask, were you so anti?
I was so anti because we want to have a show that has either has something that's interesting in it or is important, or if the heavens collide and it's both. And I found that her interview last night was neither interesting nor important. And I just, there's so much, there's great places to go see and listen to Paris Hilton, like Access Hollywood and Entertainment Tonight, and that's groovy. But I just didn't feel it.
Yeah, see, I kind of feel like one of the things I hope we can do on this show is find stuff that's, the stuff that people are talking, like real people are talking about,
sure,
at the water cooler and whatever. I don't think people even have water coolers anymore, for the record. That is the most tired, like, anachronistic phrase ever. But I just feel like I'm hoping that this show is going to be the kind of place where people, we're going to be able to talk about the things that people, real people, are really talking about. And I feel like for better or for worse, real people were talking about Paris Hilton this morning.
The real people I know who were talking about Paris Hilton were talking about why the media is covering Paris Hilton so much. So, and part of it was I didn't want to have to be part of the herd. I wanted to break out and do something different.
Well, if it's any consolation, you're going to be getting a sweet lunch out of this.
This is true, because this argument, people, has been going on for days. This is not just something that we cooked up this morning. We had a bet. Luke and I got in a very, it was almost heated, except that we're both very nice, so it didn't ever got really heated, argument about whether Paris Hilton was front page news.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. I was trying to make the example that it's going to be a big story and that the New York Times is going to put on the cover. And
to which I said, ha, not happening.
I'll bet you lunch. And you won. Although, let me just say for the record, it was on the New York Times website on the front multiple times, which doesn't mean anything.
But it was so not. It was said the New York Times website.com, where it said inside the New York Times, because you can't go inside of a homepage. We could just keep going about that.
All right, fine. Look, you know, you'll be enjoying your lunch, and I'll be enjoying the knowledge that we were giving the people what they wanted.
Caviar club sandwich.
All right, from sideshows.
Dom Perignon. Sorry.
From freak shows to sideshows, I took a little trip this week.
Yeah, you got to go out on a field trip to a birthday party slash press event slash happening out at Coney Island.
Yeah, I had never been to Coney Island. I'm kind of a recent transplant to New York, but this roller coaster, the Cyclone, turned 80 years old. And it was really funny because they wanted to do this promotion where they filled the roller coaster up with people who had ridden it 80 years ago.
Which would mean it would have to be people who are at least 87, because you would have to be 5, 6, or 7, yeah, to be on this thing when you were a kid.
Yeah, that turned out to be totally impossible. So then they kind of like, they lowered their expectations to, we just want to fill it with 80-year-olds. And so they went out and they searched the world and they were able to find 3 80-year-olds.
God bless them.
One of whom didn't feel up to actually riding the roller coaster when it was time to do it. So it ended up being 2 80-year-olds and then some roller coaster enthusiasts that were going to make this sort of like ceremonial ride. And in fact, I got a little advice. I was nervous. I'd never been on this before.
It's scary. I have actually refused to go on that roller coaster. I've actually stood on the ground and waved to my friends on the roller coaster while I was slipping my Slurpee.
It's freaky, and I was kind of nervous. And one of the guys we talked to was named Lou Pecorello. He was one of the 80-something-year-olds.
That's his real name?
Yeah, Lou Pecorello, right? Lou Pecorello and Ed Merman. This was Lou Pecorello's advice.
Don't put fear in anybody. Yeah. Nothing. That's nothing to be feared about.
Yeah, it looks a little rickety.
Yeah. Oh, it's the roughest one I've been on. The wooden coaster. It's the roughest one.
Does that add to the element of danger, the fact that it could fall apart at any moment?
Oh, no. No, it's been inspected by the city, the state, or whoever else. Oh, no, I have no fear on them at all.
It was a little hard to make out because they had this stupid band there, which is the kind of thing our producer Dan was pointing out, that it's the kind of thing that seems like a good idea when you're in a room somewhere with like the PR people, let's have a band. But then
those are the same people who said, let's get a bunch of 80-year-olds.
Right, right. But all these TV crews are there and radio people, and none of them can really use any of the tape because this infernal band is playing the whole time. But it was still really fun. And these guys, I don't know if they were spry because they ride roller coasters, or if they ride roller coasters because they're spry. But I got to tell you, Lou and Ed, I should be so lucky as to be that kind of, you know, with it when I'm 80 plus years old.
One of the coolest things about Coney Island, it's such a treasure out on the edge of New York City, and you take the subway to get there, mm-hmm. and it's just like walking back in time. Mm-hmm. But there's a really sort of sad part of this story. Coney Islands could become Coney condos.
Yeah, yeah. There's a big developer who's putting $2 billion into Coney Island, this area that we were at, this amusement park called Astroland, which is, even if you didn't grow up in New York, you know about Coney Island. It's so famous, and you have this mental image of this kind of old-timey amusement park. That is going the way of the dodo bird because they want to – it's kind of run down, though, in all honesty. Like the street right there, I think it's Ocean Avenue. That's mm-hmm. sort of where Nathan's Hot Dogs is. It's pretty run down.
Yeah,
and so, you know, this guy wants to put in all these condos and a hotel and kind of make it nice and make it a year-round destination. But this is what you always run up against, which is like part of the charm of Coney Island is that it is kind of this funky, you know, sort of rundown place. And if you change that, is it going to really be Coney Island anymore?
Will the cyclone stay, even if all that happens?
The cyclone is the only thing. It's a protected landmark. And so it will definitely stay. So that's pretty cool. And all I got to tell you that thing, it may fall down under its own weight at some point. It was like, that's the scariest part, is that it really doesn't seem like it's very sturdy.
It's a pretty scary thing. But one thing is, a good AAA baseball team named after it.
Yes.
Brooklyn Cyclones.
That's going to be our team building exercise when we actually get some BPP staffers. This is Dan Pashman's idea. A little shameless self-promotion here. We went and shot a video at the Cyclone, Wynn Rosenfeld, Dan Pashman, and I. So you got to go to our blog, which is npr.org/Bryant Park, and make sure to check out the video. It's pretty funny, I got to say. Although, let's take a quick moment, though, as we ponder that, to deal with news headlines.
Good morning. Here are the latest headlines from NPR News. The Senate Judiciary Committee issued subpoenas yesterday for documents from the White House, Vice President Dick Cheney's office, and the Justice Department over the so-called secret wiretapping program. A car bomb at a crowded Baghdad bus stop killed at least 15 people hours after an attack today in the southern city of Basra left 3 British soldiers dead. Firefighters racing the weather for control of a turbulent wildfire near Lake Tahoe got a bit of a break today as the high winds forecast to arrive by early afternoon held off, giving crews time to shore up defenses. The Supreme Court has blocked the execution of a Texas killer whose lawyers argue that he should not be put to death because he is mentally ill. Tainted Chinese toothpaste has been more widely distributed than originally thought. Roughly 900,000 tubes of toothpaste containing a poison used in some antifreeze has turned up in U.S. hospitals, prisons, and juvenile detention centers, and the FDA is urging consumers to discard all Chinese toothpaste. Fashion designer Liz Claiborne has died. She built a fashion empire by taking women out of uptight suits and designing a wide range of affordable, colorful separates. She was often called the working woman's best friend. She died of cancer on Tuesday at 78. New British Prime Minister Gordon Brown named his cabinet today. It includes the country's first female Home Secretary and one of the youngest foreign secretaries ever, 41-year-old David Miliband. Brown also named outgoing PM Tony Blair as Middle East envoy. Those are the latest headlines from NPR News. I'm Matt Martinez.
And thank you, Mr. Matt Martinez. Well, this edition of Make Me Care takes us to London.
Some may belittle politics, but we know who are engaged in it that it is where people stand tall. If it is on occasions the place of low skullduggery, it is more often the place for the pursuit of noble causes. And I wish everyone, friend or foe, well, and that is that, the end.
That's Tony Blair bidding so long, farewell, auf Wiedersehen, good night to the House of Commons. Shortly after he made the trip over to Buckingham Palace to submit his resignation to the Queen, she accepted and then appointed Chancellor of the Exchequer, Gordon Brown. I said I wasn't going to do bad accents.
I know you're
anymore.
I know you grew up in the classy part of New Jersey, but seriously, that accent is.
It's got to go. I'm
totally
sorry.
Not working.
All right, here's the right honorable gentleman from Kirklady after becoming Prime Minister. Just roll the tape.
This will be a new government with new priorities. And I have been privileged to have been granted the great opportunity to serve my country. And at all times, I will be strong in purpose, steadfast in will, resolute in action, in the service of what matters to the British people, meeting the concerns and aspirations of our whole country.
So Mr. Brown is the 52nd prime minister. So what? I'm guessing most Americans wouldn't recognize him if he walked up to them and offered them free tea.
Yeah, his wife kind of looks like Dr. Melfi from The Sopranos.
She does look like Lorraine Bracco.
That's kind of interesting, I guess.
And with so many issues going on here at home, from gas prices to White House subpoenas, is the changing of the guard at 10 Downing Street so important as to devote brain cells and, frankly, the time to thinking about it? That's where the BPP comes in. Joining us now to make us care is Stryker McGuire, who has been the London bureau chief for Newsweek for the past decade. And Stryker, I'm going to set the clock at 60 seconds, and I'm going to give you 60 seconds to make me care about Prime Minister Gordon Brown. Go.
So I'm not allowed to just say I can't manage to do this.
Come on, you're up to the challenge. I know you are.
Let me give it a shot.
Okay.
This is difficult because, as far as most Americans are concerned, there have been three prime ministers in Britain since World War II. So you have Churchill, Thatcher, and Blair. So it's going to be difficult for Gordon Brown to catch America's attention, but he should, and Americans should pay attention, basically for three reasons. One is history, one is Iraq, and the other is the economy. As for history, there are hardly any two closer allies in the world who have done more together since World War II. Iraq, both countries are obviously in there. Both countries want to get out of there, and they're going to be much better off if they're working together in getting out of there. And the third thing is the economy. And there is something called the City of London, which is London's financial district. More money goes through there than through Wall Street every day, and that at least should matter to Americans.
Stryker, you told me something I didn't even know. I never knew that about London and Wall Street.
Well, that's why I'm telling you.
Excellent.
Starting to almost make me care. This is amazing.
Let's break this down a little bit. We'll talk about that relationship. Based on his personality and his priorities, is it likely that Brown will have the same sort of chummy relationship with President Bush that Mr. Blair had?
No.
Simply.
No, I mean, in fact, he doesn't want to have that kind of relationship. That relationship basically killed Blair politically. And Gordon Brown obviously doesn't need that problem right now. And what he will do is he's not going to be anti-American. He's not going to be anti-Bush. But simply by not being Blair, he solves what was one of the big problems that Blair had, which was his poodle-like proximity to Bush got him into serious trouble here.
Yeah, literally, right? Wasn't there the George Michael video that had Bush leading Blair on a leash?
Yes.
You also mentioned Iraq. How will the UK's involvement in Iraq change under Brown's leadership?
Well, already Britain is withdrawing troops and has been withdrawing troops for some time. At the time of the invasion, Britain had nearly 50,000 troops in Iraq. Britain now has, I think, something maybe about 5,500, and the numbers are coming down, and the American numbers will come down too.
I'm just kind of wondering, I mean, these guys are both from the same party. Are there any sort of, aside from just not really being as gung-ho about Iraq, I mean, are there any real substantial differences in the way that Brown wants to do his job versus what Tony Blair was doing?
Not huge differences, although...
Now you're making me not care.
Yeah.
Going in the wrong direction, Stryker.
Is this called almost make me care?
Sure.
Or try really hard to make me care, but it doesn't matter if you fail? No, they are, in big, broad terms, they're quite similar. There are people who suspect Gordon Brown of being a bit to the left of Blair. I think that's simplistic, and I'm not sure it's true. And in any event, Gordon Brown is going to be spending a lot of time convincing people otherwise because he wants to occupy the center.
Yet he spoke quite a bit about making changes.
Well, the big change is he's there and Blair's not.
Right.
And so that's change number one. But, you know, there was a... let's give him some credit. There's a huge problem that he needs to solve, and that is trust. in government. Iraq basically, in this country, destroyed trust between the people and the government. That's a big job that Brown has to He's got to fix that, and he's got to fix it before the next election.
Well, Stryker, before I let you go, thank you so much for helping to make us care. We're going to put this up on our website, and we'll let people decide if we were able to accomplish that. You did a fine job, I thought, as well. But how did you get the name Stryker McGuire? Is that your real name?
Seriously, dude.
Now I'm really going to make you care. From my mother. It's my mother's maiden name. She gave it to me as my name. I've had it always, and it was a brilliant marketing move on her part. She obviously knew that I was going to be a journalist and I would be on NPR someday, and somebody would ask me this question.
Either that, or you'd be some sort of superhero.
Well, there is that. It's spelled with a Y, if that makes any difference.
Yeah, Luke Burbank and Stryker McGuire. We're ready to take on the forces of evil, or at least boringness, I think.
Stryker McGuire from Newsweek magazine. You have been a sport and a great help. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks.
You know, Allison, we have an interesting story coming up in the next segment. We're going to talk about the world of pro wrestling. Now, even if you don't care about pro wrestling, there are all kinds of rumors now and speculation that the steroid use is so widespread that it's literally killing huge numbers of pro wrestlers.
And this is obviously due to the story, that horrible story coming out of Georgia.
Yeah,
about
that guy,
Chris
Benoit. So we're going to talk to somebody who writes a wrestling magazine about that.
And that is all coming up on the Bryant Park Project.
Support for NPR comes from AT&T. Introducing wireless from AT&T, formerly Singular. The new AT&T, your world delivered. Boston Scientific, committed to delivering what's next in medical technology to help clinicians improve and extend lives. BostonScientific.com. And the Kauffman Foundation, featuring Good Capitalism, Bad Capitalism by Will Baumol, Bob Litton, and Carl Schramm at Kauffman.org. This is NPR.
I think this is the part where you talk, Allison.
Oh, I was looking at segment three where it says Benoit, Luke Burbank. Am I wrong?
Look at the top. It says it's the BPP from NPR News. Allison Stewart here with you.
Okay, ready? Here we go.
Okay.
It's the BPP from NPR News. I'm Allison Stewart here with you.
And I'm Luke Burbank.
This evening marks the first step of the healing process. Tonight, WWE performers will do what they do better than anyone else in the world. Entertain you.
Allison, that is Vince McMahon from this week, a broadcast of the WWE, the Pro Wrestling Network. He's talking about this guy, Chris Benoit, who by all appearances, killed his family and then himself.
It's a sad story.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. And in fact, it put the Wrestling Federation in a weird spot because the first night they didn't actually know. They just knew he and his family had passed away. So they ran this big tribute. And then it came out that he was a murderer. And so they then had to run this sort of retraction the next night. But sort of larger than that, what it's opened up is this whole conversation about pro wrestlers and the amount of steroids that they are using by you know, sort of people who want to be identified, people who don't want to be identified, people who've worked in the industry. Our producer, Dan Pashman, scared up this list of pro wrestlers who have died at a young age. And if you're like me and you grew up a big wrestling fan in the 80s, these names are people that I used to have T-shirts with their faces on it. Adrian Adonis, he died at 34. Ravishing Rick Rude, he died at 41. The Big Boss Man, he died at 42. Someone named Bam Bam Bigelow.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah, he was like a faux cop thing happening with a big tattoo on it. He died, he was only 45. Hawk from the Road Warriors, Hawk and Animal, he died when he was 46. So we wanted to find out a little bit more about that, and we got on the phone a guy named Brian Alvarez. Brian Alvarez is actually a professional wrestler himself, but he's also the editor of Figure Four Weekly, which is a newsletter that covers pro wrestling. He also co-hosts Wrestling Observer Live, which is a show on Sirius Satellite Radio, which this show is going to be on too. So see, it's a little synergy.
A little synergy.
Of the Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, Brian, are you there?
Yeah, how you doing?
Hey, great. Thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thanks for having me.
So I guess the first question is just how widespread is this steroid use in pro wrestling, you think?
It's pretty widespread. It's been pretty widespread for, you know, decades, aside from a period in the early 90s when WWE really clamped down. I saw Vince McMahon on the Today Show this morning, and if you listen to what he said, you know, the way that they have a wellness policy set up, you can be on steroids and work in WWE. You just have to be able to get a pass on the tests that they perform. And, you know, it's, as in any sport, if you want to be on something, it's possible to pass these tests. These drug tests are really IQ tests, and a lot of guys are passing. Some guys fail. But the way it's set up, if you fail, nobody really knows about it because you stay on TV, you stay on the road, you just get your pay docked for a period of time. So it's pretty clear it's widespread, and they found steroids in Benoit's home. So it's pretty clear he was either on something or very recently was on something.
Yeah, you actually knew Chris Benoit. What kind of guy was he?
He was that guy where when you hear that somebody killed their family and they talked to all the neighbors and everything like that, you'll hear them either say, everybody should have seen this coming, or you'll hear him say, he was the nicest guy in the world, I can't believe this. And that was the Chris Benoit that I knew, and that was the Chris Benoit that everybody in WWE knew. He was so polite and so humble and so quiet, and, you know, he chuckled a little bit. He didn't laugh a lot. He kind of kept to himself in many ways. But, I mean, you talk to him, and he loved his family. He always talked about his child, and it's just something that it's hit everybody so hard because in the company – He was so respected by everybody for what he'd accomplished, and now everybody has to deal with the fact that this guy that a lot of guys grew up idolizing and wanting to emulate, you know, did this.
So is there any watchdog group or overriding body who would be able to recognize that somebody like Chris Benoit, if it does turn out that he was on steroids and maybe that did have something to do with the horrible tragedy that happened, is there some sort of watchdog group or overriding body that would have been able to see the signs or measure that there was an issue?
In this situation, well, there is no overriding body. I mean, the overriding body would be WWE, and what they do is their wellness policy. And Chris Benoit is, you know, he's proof that policy, there's something wrong with it.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, I mean, he was a guy that when this first happened, when people first got word that Benoit and his family had been found dead, everybody immediately thought, well, somebody must have broken in and killed them. There must have been a gas leak. There must have been some sort of horrible tragedy because nobody could have ever imagined. I mean, this was the last guy you would think would do something like this. So it's sort of hard. He wasn't one of those guys that you saw a lot of warning signs. There were some warning signs. There were some strange behaviors, but they weren't strange enough that, I mean, everybody has strange behaviors. He had a little bit of change in his life, and he was very sad, you know, based on the death of his best friend in this business, Eddie Guerrero. But it was nothing where you would have seen that and thought, God, this guy's going to just lose his mind and go crazy.
Well, his buddy, Eddie Guerrero, died back in 2005, and he was like a lot of these wrestlers who have died either of a drug overdose or an enlarged heart, which is usually related to steroid use. I guess I'm kind of wondering, what's worse for these wrestlers? Is it the steroid abuse or is it just the lifestyle of being a wrestler? Because it seems like if one doesn't get you, the other thing will.
Well, it's actually most of the guys, I think it would have been a combination of all of those factors because steroids have been in sports and in this business for decades. And the thing, I mean, you mentioned a lot of the guys that you watched growing up in the 80s. And in the 80s, that was a big period for recreational drug use in this entire country. And you had a lot of guys making a lot of money, living a rock star lifestyle, a lot of drugs, and a lot of steroids. And you'll hear steroid users that get very upset when they hear, well, steroids killed these guys. But a lot of steroid users will claim that they're using steroids in a responsible manner, whatever that might be.
I was about to say, what does that mean exactly?
And why am I not surprised when they get angry?
Is cycling steroids. Like, you'll go on a three-month cycle or whatever and come off for 3 months, that sort of thing. And the way you have to look at pro wrestling is there's no off-season. It's not like guys are training for a bodybuilding contest every 6 months. These guys are on TV every single week. So if a guy is on steroids, he doesn't have 3 months to come off. He doesn't have any time to cycle. And I can't say this for 100% certainty, but my guess would be that for the great part of the last 20 years, Chris Benoit was on steroids through that entire period. There may have been, you know, a period here or there where he got off stuff, but, I mean, this is a long, long, long-term abuse of a drug that doesn't just – it's not just your biceps and your lats and whatever that grow. It's every muscle in your body. I mean, you can't tell steroids what you want bigger. It's everything. And your heart's a muscle. And, you know, it's no surprise that you would find guys, steroid users, dying due to enlarged hearts. And with guys that take GH, just enlarged organs, you know, internal organs. So, yeah.
Brian Alvarez, professional wrestler and also the editor of Figure Four Weekly, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me.
Here are some of the stories that NPR News is following at this hour. The White House is fighting two sets of subpoenas, one dealing with the administration's wiretapping program, the other dealing with fired federal prosecutors.
The Supreme Court has blocked an execution. There's more tainted Chinese toothpaste out there than originally thought, and wildfires continue to rage near Lake Tahoe. Stay tuned for a full news update at the top of the hour. But first,
Allison, I got to say, you have been I'm not criticizing your level of work, but you have been checking up on Dingle, Ireland a lot because you're going there next week.
I am in Google heaven when I am Googling Dingle. I'm headed off to vacation
soon. You and Matt both.
Matt Martinez, our producer, is headed to Phoenix, Arizona. You are headed to next week.
Los Angeles,
California. And Dan Pashman, one of our producers, is headed to Croatia. Because if you're looking to get away, you should try this on your significant other. Hey, honey, let's go to the Balkans. Now, if your other stares at you blankly and utters something about finding it hard to relax in a formerly war-torn area, we got to let him in on a little secret. It's become
And you're not talking about Phoenix.
No.
You're talking about.
We're talking about Croatia. First of all, you're probably thinking to yourself, and it's okay, where's Croatia?
Yeah.
All right. Make a fist with your left hand. Quick. Stick out your index finger and your thumb.
Okay.
That's the shape of Croatia, okay? Your thumb on the outside is bordering the Adriatic Sea, and across the Adriatic Sea is Italy. And the top of your index finger, Hungary's above there.
Okay?
So just so you got a sense.
Yeah, that really helped.
Well,
I feel like I'm there.
All right. Someone who's going to help you be there is Jean Oliver. She's the sole author of The Lonely Planet's popular Croatia guidebook. You can also visit her website, croatiatraveler.com. Hey, Jean, so when did Croatia start to gain in popularity and why?
Well, Croatia, before the breakup of Yugoslavia, ex-Yugoslavia, was really popular, especially with Europeans. It was a major destination. And, of course, the war in the 1990s really put up an abrupt end to all of that. But the last 7 or 8 years, they've been crawling back and have now become an amazingly popular destination once again. They have a tremendous amount to offer. First of all, there's Dubrovnik, and that's on everybody's travel itinerary, must-do list, must-visit list, I think. There's just no place like it, really, in the world. It's completely unique. They don't make them like that anymore. Walled city on the Adriatic with a fascinating history, gorgeous beaches all around it. So that's a major highlight of Croatia. And then there's over 1,100 islands in Croatia.
So you can take ferries out to those islands?
Oh, yes, yes. Not all of the islands are inhabited. So the ones, there's 66 inhabited islands, so you're kind of confined to those, unless you have your own yacht. If you have your own boat, then you can really do quite a lot. But all of the other islands are connected by ferry to the mainland. You have to be very careful about ferry schedules, though. There's not ferries between the islands or among the islands, this regularity that we'd like. But there's a tremendous amount to see on the Croatian coast and the islands, so it's really become quite a hot spot. And it's also a now a major hot spot for the yachting crowd, and movie stars are tying up their yachts in southern Dalmatia.
Probably not a lot of paparazzi in off the coast of Croatia. Hey, you know, people go to people go to Florence to see art, and they go to Prague to see these pristine architecture. What do you go to Croatia to see?
I think right now Croatia is a sun and sea destination, and people are going for that fabulous stretch of coastline and the islands that are very much untouched, many of them, forested, all very different, remote fishing villages. So I think that the coast and the islands is what's attracting people now, but Croatia also has an amazing history as well. It's a lot of the coast had belonged to Venice for a number of centuries, and there's a very strong Venetian influence in the architecture, the way that the villages are set up, and in the food, which is very Italian-influenced. So there's really a great deal.
I was about to say, you're talking my language. What about the language barrier? Is that a big issue for Americans?
It really isn't. Croatians have always had a pretty good grasp of other languages.
It's not a problem because everybody there just speaks English.
Well, I wouldn't say everybody. The younger crowd, anybody under 25, is going to have a pretty good grasp of English. And all up and down the coast, the people are very focused on tourism, and English is a very essential language. So it's not a problem getting around at all. Deep into the interior, the northern part of Croatia, probably would be a little bit more difficult. There, German would be a second language to Croatian. But along the coast, people speak, of course, Croatian first, and then Italian, and then English.
Bene.
Really not a problem getting around.
Hey, Gene, we just have about 20 seconds left, but I'm curious because I'm always looking at the bottom line. Is it cheap? Is it cheaper than other places you could visit that have a similar climate and stuff?
I think it's that's one of the big attractions for Croatia right now. Given the weakness of the dollar against the euro, Croatia is a very good budget destination for Americans especially. It's less expensive than other islands, other island destinations in the Mediterranean, the coast of Spain, probably less expensive than Greece, I would say, certainly less expensive than the French Riviera. So there's still really good value. It's not as expensive as it probably is going to be in a few more years. So this is a good time to go.
There are about 4.5 million people in the country. How do the Croats feel about all these backpacking Americans showing up in their front lawn and saying, show me something?
Well, Croatians are very welcoming to tourism to begin with. Their economy kind of depends on it. And before the breakup of Yugoslavia, it had depended on it. And then the war years, they really took a nosedive. And they're pretty happy to get tourists back. They like Americans, really, for two reasons. First of all, during the war and the breakup of Yugoslavia, Americans gave them some very material support under the Clinton administration. And secondly, Americans have a reputation of traveling a little bit off-season. Croatia can get southern Dalmatia especially. The coast can get really filled up for about 6 weeks in July and August, and Americans can kind of fill the gap in the shoulder season, often come at very good times of the year, June, September, which are great times to be in Croatia.
Well, Gene Oliver, we thank you so much for sharing all information Croatian.
Hey, that rhymes.
Thank you very much. And I have a lot of information on my website, croatiatraveler.com.
Thanks,
that's
Gene.
A good resource.
All right.
Thank you.
Allison, you know, it's time for my favorite part of the show. Wait, this is the first time we've ever done a show. But it's my new favorite. It's called The Ramble. So CNN.com has this story about a grad student at Northwestern University who's studying how gay people walk.
What?
And he's created these amazing videos where you can't see the person. You can't see what they look like. You just see the kind of representation of their body's shape. And he has gay people and straight people walking. And then he asks other people to try to identify which is the gay person, which is the straight person. And it's all – basically, he's trying to find out if gaydar exists.
See, now I live in a gayborhood, and I got to tell you, I don't think he can tell the difference.
But this guy is not – I got to say, this guy is not homophobic or – I mean, he's really a sort of a scientist who's curious about if there are physiological components to being homosexual. And this is part of a growing kind of field of science. But you got to go to our blog and check on the videos because it's fun to watch.
All right, let's talk about the heterosexuals now. They are doing something that I find just odd. This Philadelphia couple has won – I put in question mark after it – a contest where they're only going to communicate with one another through messages written on M&Ms. You know, M&Ms have this thing where you can put messages. You can think, hey, I'm Luke Burbank, and you can give them out to chicks.
Yeah, you can specially order these,
if you
right?
Like. Yes. So they have about 9,000 different M&Ms, and it's the only way they're going to communicate. The reason they're doing this, they get $1,000 for every day that they don't speak to each other and only communicate through these written M&Ms.
Yeah. You know, I think the not talking is usually like year 5 of the marriage. I don't know why you want to fast forward it. Thank you, M&M, for ruining another marriage. You're awesome. Hey, Allison, you remember J.T. Leroy?
Yes.
He was that gay teenage runaway with these amazing stories about his life as a prostitute at truck stops. The only problem was that J.T. Leroy doesn't actually exist.
No, it's a woman, right?
Yeah, it's this like 41-year-old mother from Brooklyn. Her name is Laura Albert. Well, she just lost a $116,000 judgment this week because these people who had bought the rights to J.T. Leroy's life for a movie, now the movie's not so awesome being that there's no J.T. Leroy. So they sued her. They won $116,000. And
She committed fraud was the idea, right?
Yeah, right, exactly. And so where is she going to get that money from? Well, she tells Page Six of the New York Post that she's fully willing to pose for Playboy. Ugh. So just keep your eye open for that one.
All right, do you know my home state of New Jersey does not have a state song? So some kids have gotten together and they want to make a Bon Jovi song, the one that they're actually using in the tourism ad now, the New Jersey state song, J Bon J.
J Bon J, is that what you call him in the Garden State?
That's what we all call him. Now, we have a state bird, a finch, we have a red oak, we have a flower, but no song.
Well, if there's anybody that can do it, it's the guy who wrote Slippery When Wet. Actually, that's an album. That's not even the name of a song.
So, we'll see if I'll be singing J Bon J as my state song very soon. I don't think so.
Allison, the clock up above us says 4 zeros, which I think means we have just done an hour of the Bryant Park Project.
We made it.
How do you feel?
Feeling good.
All right. We'll see you at the bar.